Today is November 7th. It's our fifth class in the most important Talmudic passages. And tonight, I should say today, we're doing two Talmudic passages on the same subject. And I entitled it Study Versus Work, or the Spiritual Versus the Physical. Another source sheet over there. Okay. In both of these Talmudic passages, which I'm sure you'll find fascinating, the central figure is Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. And I'm sure that many of you have heard of him before, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. I'll just say one word, that traditionally the book of Jewish mysticism, the Zohar, is attributed to him. This is to say that the book is written according to the book by him, and he's telling stories and teaching Torah. Now, historically, researchers and historians don't believe it was really written by him, but it's still fascinating that tradition attributes the book to him. It means he is, in many senses, the founder of Jewish mysticism, with everything that mysticism symbolizes. We'll understand the connection between him and mysticism as we go through these two passages in the Talmud. One more thing, which is everything we're going to learn in the next 55 minutes is directly relevant to news in Israel today. By today I mean the past 50 years. And deeply relevant to the meaning of what is Judaism's place in the modern world. Here we go. Everyone have the sheets. Babylonian Talmud, Tractate Brachot, page 35b. I'll read it through, it's short, and then we'll go back and try to figure it out. Our rabbis taught, and thou shalt gather in thy grain. That's a verse from the Torah. We'll go back later and look at it. What is to be learnt from these words? The words we just read, thou shalt gather in thy grain. Since it says, this book of the law shall not depart out of thy mouth. That's a verse from the book of Joshua. I might think that this injunction is to be taken literally. Therefore it says, and thou shalt gather in thy grain. Just a superficial explanation. The book of the law of the Torah shall not depart out of thy mouth. You might think, therefore, that the only thing you're supposed to do, day and night, that exception is, have the Torah in your mouth. Speak words of Torah. Study Torah. Sit in the Beit Midrash. You might have thought that's all, absolutely all a Jew should do in his life. Therefore, when the verse comes and says, thou shalt gather in thy grain, you learn there's something else to do in life. In addition to learning Torah, you're also supposed to work in the fields. Which implies, I'm back to that fourth line, which implies that you are to combine the study of them, Torah, with a worldly occupation. This is the view of Rabbi Yishmael. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, is that possible? Is it possible to combine learning Torah with a worldly occupation? If a man plows in the plowing season, and sows in the sowing season, and reaps in the reaping season, and threshes in the threshing season, and winnows in the season of the wind, what is to become of the Torah? Rather, when Israel performs the will of the Omnipresent, in other words, when we learn Torah, when we do the mitzvot, their work is performed by others. As it says, and strangers shall stand and feed your flocks. And when Israel does not perform the will of the Omnipresent, their work is carried out by themselves. As it says, and thou shalt gather in thy grain. Nor is this all, but the work of others is also done by them, as it says, and thou shalt serve your enemy. Said Abaye, a later sage, hundreds of years after Rabbi Yishmael and Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, many have followed the advice of Rabbi Yishmael and has worked well. Others have followed Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai and has not been successful. Rabbi said to the rabbis, I would ask you not to appear before me during Nisan and Tishrei, so that you may not be anxious about your food supply during the rest of the year. Okay, now I have to go back and understand. Before we go back to understand it, let me throw out a question. In the largest sense, in the broadest terms, what is this about? Can anyone figure, what is it really about?
what's the most important thing? What should be our
priority?
Our main occupation.
Absolutely, that's true. Absolutely, but can we say it in conceptual terms, in broader terms?
Study or work.
Okay, that's true, but it's basically the same thing that Chip said. It's absolutely true. That's what it's about. But a little bit broader, a little bit more conceptual. Well, I would say it's really about the relationship between the spiritual and the physical. I'm just broadening a little bit. Because the study of Torah here, for Jews, is what we call spirituality. That's Jewish spirituality. That's the realm of the spirit, of the soul, of religion, of God. And then the work in the fields, that's the occupation, that's the whole involvement of the physical world. And the question really is, what's really central? The physical world or the spiritual world? Where should you put your marbles? Where should you focus yourself? On this or on that?
You're saying spiritual.
I'm saying?
No, it looks like spiritual.
According to who?
The first one.
What does the first one mean?
Maybe the second.
Maybe the second.
Or maybe none.
Right? But Beverly is right. There's two opinions. And it turns out that in this grand question of what is the most central value, is it the physical or the spiritual, there's a machloket, there's an argument, there's a disagreement. So now let's go back and try and parse it. So I'm going to read again, okay? Our rabbis taught, "And thou shalt gather in thy grain." Let's look up the verse. You'll be surprised where it comes from. So if we see a note at the end of the passage, it says Deuteronomy 11. So if we look in Deuteronomy 11, verse 13, 14, 15, see something pretty fascinating. In the English only of the JPS, it's page 292. In other editions, of course, it's on a different page. Deuteronomy 11, 13. Deuteronomy 11:13, page 292 in the English only of the JPS. The Hebrew begins, "Im shemoa tishmu kol mitzvotai." That sound familiar to anyone?
It's a second paragraph.
That's from the Shema. This is from the second paragraph of the Shema. Something that traditionally Jews have said twice a day for thousands of years. "If then you obey the commandments that I enjoin upon you this day, loving the Lord your God and serving Him with all your heart and soul, I will grant the rain for your land in season, the early rain, the later rain. You shall gather in your new grain and wine and oil. I will also provide grass in the fields for the cattle. You shall eat your fill." So, when it says you shall gather in your new grain and wine and oil, that is a promise. It's a blessing. It's a blessing. But of course, that blessing is not that bread comes out of the sky like manna from heaven. It doesn't grow on trees. That you have to work the fields and plow and plant and harvest, and you'll have grain. It's a bracha. If it says if you do the mitzvot, God will reward you with the bracha of prosperity. But prosperity depends on your own physical efforts. That's clear. So now going back to the text, the rabbis ask, what's to be learned from the words? Kof, those words again are about a blessing. But they include within them the assumption that you have to do some work to get this blessing from God. Why do we have to be told that? So the story says, because of that verse in Yoshua, in the book of Joshua, that says, "This book of the law, Sefer Torah Hazeh, shall not depart out of thy mouth." And the verse goes on to say, "Yomam v'layla, day or night." And it sounds like Joshua is saying, you're supposed to learn the Torah, right? I'm back on the sheets in the Talmudic passage. You're supposed to learn the Torah day and night. Now we understand, says the Talmud, why we had to be told in those verses in the Shema that the blessing of God has to come from your own efforts in the field. Because you might have thought you're not supposed to make any efforts in the field. You're supposed to be studying the Torah day and night. And why would I think that? of course, because the Torah was given to us as a gift from heaven. It's God's book. It's totally divine. It's supernal. And the study of Torah, of course, is the preeminent mitzvah. Of course I would think I'm supposed to learn Torah day and night. And why would I think I'm supposed to dirty my hands in the field? The field is physical. The field is not godlike. The field is mundane. The field is corporal. So certainly I think I'm supposed to learn Torah all day. No. The verse tells you, gather in your grain, there's something good, there's something important, there's something crucial in going into the field yourself, even though there's also a mitzvah to study Torah day and night. So already at this point we hear that this is telling us something about my favorite word in Judaism, balance.
Balance.
Right? Balance. About an equilibrium. No one said it's not a mitzvah to learn Torah. It is. It's a mitzvah to learn Torah day and night. But there's also some type of value in going into the field and bringing your own food. We didn't define yet what that value is, but it's also important. Therefore, you have to learn to do two at the same time. In Hebrew, we say you have to learn to dance at two weddings. Mm-hmm.
I'm sorry. Aren't there huge passages in the Tanakh that tells you how to do business? You're supposed to do it in a certain manner, and it's supposed to fit in with all the commandments that you do. So if there's all these long passages that tell you how to do business, doesn't that tell you that's what you're supposed to do also?
Leslie is right. Leslie is right. If you just read the Tanakh, even though there is a verse in Joshua that says learn Torah day and night, still, if you just learned the Tanakh, you probably wouldn't even feel yourself faced by this dilemma. Because for Tanakh, it's clear that Judaism is about this world. It is clear, but when you get to the Talmudic period, with other religions around, especially Christianity, that emphasize spirituality, 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 and after Jews have been learning Torah and serving God for thousands of years, there is a natural tendency to start asking, wait a second, what is the value of this world? I know that Tanakh talks about it all the time, but really, what is the value of it? I mean, God is other. God is spiritual. God is not corporal. So why am I involved in the corporal world? So a question that the Tanakh doesn't ask. To the Tanakh, it's a given. It's obvious that this is the place to live. This is the place of importance. It's this world. But that's not obvious anymore in later generations. Because again, if you think about it from a religious perspective, especially with Christianity in the air, why should I be involved in this world? What's good about this world that so many other religions are calling dirty and mundane and corporal and animal-like? What's good about it? So we didn't yet say what's good about it, but this comes to emphasize that even though you're supposed to study Torah day and night, there is some value in this world, and you have to, again, balance. We didn't talk about the values yet.
How do the ultra-Orthodox in Israel, for example...
That's exactly what I was going to ask.
The woman is right. In other words, when I said 10 minutes ago, this is really on the front page of the newspapers in Israel for the past 50 years, it absolutely is. And in the discussions that you're referring to, when you go beyond the newspapers to the articles and to the books, this passage is central to the discussion. I had a professor in Hebrew University who was doing my master's in Jewish philosophy who liked to say that when you learn, he liked to say, you can only understand the headlines on the newspapers in Israel by learning Jewish philosophy. Amazing thing, right? Now, of course, no one knows that. Most people read the headlines, whether they're Americans or Israelis, they don't know that that behind those headlines are passages that Jews have been discussing for 2,000 years. For real. So, very good. And we'll get to that in a few seconds.
Is that because nothing changes?
In a certain sense, the basic questions of how to live a good life and how to interpret the Torah, they're the same questions for thousands of years, right? The more things change, the more they really remain the same.
And the answers are also the same, essentially? They never change?
Of course, there's a great similarity. There's also differences. But I would claim, as my professor claimed, to really understand the present and to deal with it properly and to navigate the future, you have to know the past. It's true in history, but it's also true in philosophy and theology. Okay, so that's good. I was really thinking of beginning the class today with a newspaper article about some disagreement, some demonstration in Israel, some protest between Haredim and secular. But that's exactly what it's about. So again, let's see the passage first. Let's not go to the present before we have the past under our belts. I'm in the end of the third line. Therefore it says, "Thou shalt gather in thy grain," which implies that you are to combine the study of them, Torah, with a worldly occupation. In Hebrew we call that Torah im derech eretz. Torah with the way of the world. Perhaps we'll even put that on the board. Torah im derech eretz. Torah im derech eretz. Now some of you probably have heard the phrase derech eretz, and you think it means ethics. That's one meaning of it. It has three meanings in Hebrew. But another meaning of the word derech eretz is life in this world. Derech eretz, the way of the world. Literally, just being in the world, the physical world. You're supposed to combine Torah, meaning here Torah study, which again is a symbol for religion and spirituality and godliness. Combine Torah with derech eretz. That's the position of Rabbi Yishmael. That's the vision of Rabbi Yishmael. Then we go on. And Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is fascinating. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says, is this possible? In other words, his first claim is not theological and not philosophical. His claim is practical. It doesn't work. Human beings are not built to live a life of balance. You have to go for the edges, for the fringe. You have to do one thing and hold on to it. You have to be dedicated to one ideal, because when you try and do two things, you don't manage to do either of them well. Right? That's his position. I'm not saying you have to agree with it. That balance doesn't work in human life. We're not built for it. We're just not built for it. Rather, you have to take one of the two and run with it. And which one am I going to take? Obviously, he says Torah. And now he explains the dilemma. Not the philosophical dilemma, rather the human dilemma. You can't do two things at once.
Can't multitask.
Well, he was a man. What do you want?
Right.
So he says, if a man plows in the plowing season, and sows in the sowing season, and reaps in the reaping season, and threshes in the threshing season, and winnows in the season of wind, what is to become of the Torah? You know, you go out into the field, you let someone spend a few days there, and he wants more. And he has to do more. He gets involved. Think of business. Think of the allure of materialism, right? That's what he's really talking about. You allow someone to immerse themselves in the physical world and they can't get themselves out of it. And the only solution is to forget about the physical world, put it aside. Because Talmud Torah Keneged Kulam, the study of Torah, is the most important mitzvah.
Isn't it kind of like man's struggle with his relationship with God? Like, we needed him more when we were in the desert, you know? We didn't have all these tools, and we didn't have any place to plow or sow or seed, so we sort of needed God more. So it was kind of like the only game in town anyway, so you just needed God. But we got into the real world, and all these things were given to us to do, so that's our struggle. You know, how much of God do we still keep in our life?
Absolutely. And you know, you're really right. That's fantastic. Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai wants us to stay in the desert, fed by the manna our whole lives.
Right.
That's the ideal. Whereas Rabbi Yishmael says that was for a period of our lives, but now we have to go into the physical world. Absolutely.
Or in the cave.
Ship is foreshadowing the next source we're going to see.
So if everybody did the best mitzvah, which would be to study Torah, and everybody did this, then...
Who's going to take care of
the next line? It's the next line. He says, rather, when Israel performed the will of the Omnipresent, their work is performed by others. In other words, miraculously, God will make sure that other people, non-Jews, will provide for us. When we're involved in spirituality, then the world will function on a level that's beyond nature, he claims, and everything will be provided for.
Right.
And he brings a verse from the book of Isaiah, which we don't have to look at.
Right.
And strangers shall stand and feed your flocks, And that's a blessing. It's a blessing to be served physically by others when we're involved in spirituality, says Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
So it's okay to have.
Then he goes further, and he said, yes.
I wanted to ask if this is a trend in the Talmud where you have the idealist purist versus the more practical.
You do have that.
All the way through the Talmud, you have these extreme over here and the more practical over here who say, wait a minute, let's do reality talk. Is that right? Is there a trend like that?
I would go back to what Anna said, that there are certain basic human, there's a range of positions, and then express themselves in many, many different areas. I'm translating what she said into something slightly different. There's always going to be, right, the more realistic, as you call it, the more spiritual. But of course, the spiritualist says, I'm not against reality, I'm just redefining what the real, true, important reality is. Right? Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, he doesn't say that I'm out of the world of reality. He says, I'm telling you what the real reality is. The spiritual world is the real reality. That physical stuff, that's not important. It's a distraction.
So this is the origin of multitasking.
Rabbi Ishmael is the origin of multitasking.
Had we been allowed to study, we could have done it all.
The origin of the women doing the work.
Exactly.
That's an interesting question. Is this for women? Is this for men only?
Men only.
The Talmud did not envision women ever learning this.
And cooked at the same time.
So the women had their wives who could do all the work and take care of the children and ran the business and whatever. And
there's a lot of truth in that. Yeah, right. Those of you in my second class on Wednesdays, when we're studying men and women in the Talmud, we've seen more than one case in which the woman stays at home and works. And the men go off for 14 years or 12 years. How many years was it? Rabbi Akiva was away for 12 years in the Beit Midrash.
This is the beginning of our role. The women's role. This is our role.
So
they didn't need strangers. They had us.
Could we also? But we also had servants.
Okay, true.
It's a good point. And then it goes and says, and when Israel do not perform the will of the omnipresent, their work is carried out by themselves.
By others.
No, by themselves.
Oh.
Right? When Israel do not perform the will of the omnipresent, their work is carried out by themselves. It says, and thou shalt gather my grain. That's an amazingly radical reinterpretation. Because what it means is the following. He's quoting the verse from the Shema, right? The verse that talks about the blessing for doing the mitzvot. The blessing for doing the mitzvot we saw is that the fields will be full of grain and you'll harvest it and have your blessing. He says that's a curse. That's not a blessing. It's a curse to have to gather in your own grain. Because when you really do the mitzvot properly, it's not that God blesses you with the ability to gather in the grain. It's that God blesses you with someone else gathering the grain and giving it to you. It's not a blessing, he says, to reap the fields. It's a curse. I don't know how he fits it into the verse. It doesn't fit into the context. But to have to get your hands dirty in this world, to have to be distracted from what's really important, the study of Torah, is a curse that's to be avoided, he says.
It sounds like with the Vilna Gaon years later, he had an argument with Hasidim, and Hasidim said, in order to help the world, you have to get dirty yourself.
Right, the Vilna Gaon was known for years upon years of
constant study.
Of closing himself off in the study, having people bring him a little bit of food every day, just learning day and night without interruption for years upon years upon years.
Could this also mean something else? But you also take part and make choices like look after yourself and do the right thing, like planting in the right season and harvesting in the right season. That you have some responsibility in this also, rather than...
That's Rabbi Ishmael.
First rabbi.
Yeah.
So is the second rabbi more just saying, you don't have any responsibility, you just study and everything will take care of itself and this world is not that important?
He's saying that, but your wording is a bit pejorative. If he would say it, he would say that we have the greatest responsibility to study Torah. That's not shirking responsibility. That is responsibility. Whereas going out to the field, that's shirking responsibility. He says, Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says, that's shirking your real responsibility. That's showing weakness to go out to the field and work, that you don't rely on God who will provide for you. That's weakness. That's not responsibility. Again, to understand both sides of the coin here.
We haven't settled it yet.
We're not finished. We're not finished. And indeed, we'll never settle it.
Don't get excited.
But we'll never settle it because these two points of view, I think, are eternal. And of course, they're probably, I'm pretty sure, you'll find this discussion not only in Judaism, but probably in many religions. It's an eternal discussion of the balance or the relationship between the upper worlds and the lower worlds, between God and spirit and the physical world. All right, we have monks and we have nuns who separate themselves from the physical world. I mean, many years ago I read the book by Hermann Hesse Siddhartha about a young Buddhist who just gets rid of all his possessions and only keeps for himself his one piece of clothing and a begging cup, and that's all you have in the world. And he goes out to beg, and most of the time just to serve God and to meditate. And that is tremendously, tremendously liberating.
He lives next door to me.
Liberating. Liberated from all physical needs.
You have no responsibility.
Most of the time,
no, you have the greatest responsibility to your soul. You always focus on the greatest responsibility to your soul and to God.
It's only on yourself.
Not personal responsibility.
It's only on yourself. It doesn't involve the rest of the world.
That's true.
You're isolating yourself.
That's true, right? The spiritual approach is much more individualistic than the corporal approach. The corporal approach, the physical approach, is really always about groups of people, about collective.
We wouldn't have a people if everybody did that.
That's absolutely true. That's absolutely true. A little bit more?
There'd be no future without it.
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would not agree that there'd be no future.
Well,
Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai says there's no future when you concentrate only in the physical.
You know, I'm curious. Rabbis that are, this is me, and it may not be relevant, is what are their backgrounds? That one can say, let other people do it, and you just study, and the other, you know, is very...
Wait brilliant. For the next source.
Okay.
Thank you for the point. We'll see how their biographies, or at least one of their biographies, are in interplay with their philosophy. Let's read the last paragraph. Set Abaye. The middle of the page, exactly. Set Abaye. Abaye is a Babylonian rabbi, again, hundreds of years after the two rabbis that we just heard about. Many have followed the advice of Rabbi Yishmael, and it's worked well. In other words, we have been able to balance. Others have followed Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, and it has not been successful. And he probably means not successful, that they haven't managed to make a livelihood. God hasn't provided. Rabbi said to the rabbis, and he says to the rabbis, to his rabbinical students, I would ask you not to appear before me during Nisan and Tishrei, which are the months that are most crucial for the planting and the plowing, and then for the harvest, so that you may not be anxious about your food supply during the rest of the year. In other words, the end of the passage clearly comes down on the side of Rabbi Yishmael about the balance. And there's no doubt that if you look at the Tanakh, clearly it is about the balance, and as we said earlier, the question doesn't even arise in Tanakh. Tanakh clearly is of the philosophy that Judaism and meaning and what we'd call spirituality and God are in this world. It's not about leaving this world for another world, as Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai would have us do. After the Holocaust, let me put it this way. Traditionally, for 2,000 years, Jews have followed the approach of Rabbi Yishmael. You really don't find Jewish monks. You don't find almost any rabbis that devote themselves 24 hours a day, or see, 20 hours a day, you have to sleep a little bit, just to learning Torah.
Except for the Valley of God.
There have been rare exceptions, but by and large, we have followed the approach of Rabbi Yishmael, of balance. What happened is, I'll make a long story very short, But after the Holocaust, there was a conscious decision made by a group of Haredi rabbis, of ultra-Orthodox rabbis, that the time has come to put balance aside because the Jewish people is in peril. Many of us don't realize, we know that 6 million Jews perished in the Holocaust. We understand the physical loss. But there's also another side of the coin, which is the spiritual and institutional loss. The centers of Judaism that give it its spiritual power and really its longevity and its meaning, all those institutions were concentrated exactly where the Nazis did their worst damage. We lost our spiritual institutions. We lost the whole tradition of Torah study. There were hundreds and hundreds of yeshivot there that really were the backbone of the Jewish people from a spiritual point of view. And the decision was made by Rav Aaron Kotler in the U.S. and made by the Chazon Ish in Israel and a few others, that we have to put balance aside and focus only on learning Torah. And they were aware of the dangers. Everyone knows the story that when Ben Gurion in 1948 agreed for the yeshiva boys to be exempt from the army, as was demanded by the Chazon Ish, who was the great Haredi leader in Bnei Brak in 1948. How many was it? 300 or 3,000 boys, I remember, were learning in yeshiva, not more than that. And it made sense for the army to exempt them, and it made sense for the Haredi community to support those 3,000 boys. They saw those 3,000 boys as the backbone of the future of the Jewish people. The same thing in America. Rav Aaron Kotler founded Yeshivat Lakewood, the Yeshiva of Lakewood in New Jersey, which today has over 3,000 boys. Then it was about 30, going back 50 years ago. The idea was that we have to rebuild the institutions of the Jewish people because they're all completely gone. And it calls now for radical measures. What's happened now, fast forward, is it's been successful beyond their wildest dreams. But now that lack of balance has been institutionalized. And how do we go back to the balance? The Haredi world, as far as I understand, is aware of the issue, at least some of them. But how do you go back to the balance is a difficult, difficult question. And of course, whenever we in the secular world or in the non-Haredi world try attack them for lack of balance, of course they respond by putting up the barricades and saying, no, this is the way it's supposed to be. But most of them know this is not the way it's supposed to be. But it's extremely difficult to recalibrate all these institutions and go back to more balanced way of life. But just say one more thing. And the lack of balance is really, really bad for Haredi society. And it has a very insidious effect in Israeli society when you have more and more people that haven't been taught to live the value of making a living, of being involved with the physical world, of appreciating God's gifts as they are, in the world we see. It's a serious, serious issue, and it deserves to be on the front page of the newspapers, as it so many times is in Israel.
In the overall scheme of Judaism, though, aren't they kind of balanced? I mean, In the overall scheme of Judaism, they are kind of balanced. I mean, they're way over here in the secular.
Good point.
World is way over here, and they sort of bring us to the middle, and that's.
That's a very good point. That's a good point. Right. As far as their world, it's tremendously unbalanced, and it has some serious social effects. But in the grand scheme, it's balancing out the rest of the Jewish world, you could say.
I hear.
So, what I'd like to do now is take just 2 or 3 minutes, perhaps even 4, to flesh out the philosophical issues we've just discussed, not flesh them out, but rather to just diagram them, and then to go on to another story that gives some more background to this really interesting issue. So, on the last page, I just wrote for us what's going on here from a philosophical point of view. And the top it says, why does Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai say that one should learn only Torah? Because Torah is the preeminent mitzvah and all time and energy should be devoted to it. Makes sense? That's the verse in Joshua. And because our highest aspiration is to connect to God. God is non-corporal. And it's not through the corporal world that one connects to Him. That's also seems obvious. It would seem obvious. One connects to God only through the spiritual, intellectual pursuit of Torah study. That's His claim. that assumes, of course, there's little or no value in work. It denigrates the physical. It means Jews are meant to live in the spiritual. And then point three is what we emphasized, that he doesn't believe in balance. It just doesn't work. Once you get involved in the world, you can't extricate yourself from it. That's Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai. That's the unique position that we saw that is basically rejected in the Talmudic passage. Whereas Rabbi Yishmael, I'm just going to read what I wrote. Why does Rabbi Yishmael say Yushev Torah at the worldly occupation to balance? He must certainly admit that study of Torah is a preeminent mitzvah. So if it's a preeminent mitzvah, how can you do something else? The answer is he believes there's a value in work. Everyone remember the verse in the Torah that says 6 days you should do your labor, right? And the seventh day you should rest? Many, many Tanaim, that is to say rabbis of the Mishnaic period, understood that 6 days you should work, that's a mitzvah. It's not just background to Shabbat, it's a mitzvah. There's a value in work. And what is that value? Well, Rabbi Yishmael probably holds, like those rabbis, that there's a value, there's a mitzvah in work. What is the value? And I listed here four possibilities that are found in the literature. Not to live in poverty, to enjoy the world. If the world is here, perhaps God wants us to get something out of it in a physical sense. Number two, not to rely on a miracle for sustenance. Number three, to burn off physical energy. The assumption being, if you don't burn off your physical energy with something positive, you'll burn off with something negative. You'll use those passions and that energy for sin, which gets to the second class that I give on Wednesday mornings. And the fourth point is, because we're commanded to develop and civilize the world. Like it says in the creation story, we're here to conquer and to subdue the earth, to make it better. That's technology, that's medicine, that's all of the advancements. It's good, it's our purpose here to continue the work of creation that God began. That might be what's standing behind the approach of Rabbi Yishmael. Of course, according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, there's no mitzvah to work, there's no value to develop this world, civilization isn't a value. The only value is the spirit, according to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
Olam? He just ignores that?
Absolutely, no tikkun olam. According to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, there's no such thing as tikkun olam, and that will come out very forcefully in the next story we're going to read. You ready for the next story?
Yes, sir.
Okay. The story we're about to read is known by generations upon generations of Jewish children from the age of five. The story is told in kindergartens throughout Israel, and I'm sure throughout America as well. Many kids know the story, but who knows what it really means? Rabbi Yehuda, Rabbi Yossi, and Rabbi Shimon, that's our Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai, were sitting, and Yehuda ben Girim was sitting beside them. Rabbi Yehuda commenced the discussion by observing, "How fine are the works of this people. They have made streets, they have built bridges, they have erected baths." Rabbi Yossi was silent. Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai answered and said, "All that they've made for themselves. They built marketplaces to set harlots in them, baths to rejuvenate themselves, bridges to levy tolls for them." Now Yehuda ben Girim went and related their words, which reached the government. They decreed, "Yehuda, who exalted us, shall be exalted. Yossi, who was silent, shall be exiled to Sepphoris." That's in the north of Israel. "Shimon, who disparaged, let him be executed." So let's go back, just understand the opening of the story here. There's a lot more. So when Rabbi Yehuda said in the end of the second line and the beginning of the third, "How fine are the works of this people," you could have expected, being that he's a rabbi, he means how fine are the Torah works of the Jewish people, how fine are their interpretations, how fine are their deeds, their mitzvot. But he doesn't mean that at all, as we learn in the next sentence. He means the Romans. He doesn't mean the Jews. He's exalting the Romans. They've made streets. They built bridges. They erected baths. In other words, Rabbi Yehuda has a great appreciation of Roman culture, of technology, of civilization, of making life more productive, making life flourish, that there should be cities, there should be commerce, there should be building. Life becomes easier, more productive, and perhaps even holds that this is like a mitzvah they're doing. It's good for the world. God wants us to tikkun olam. Tikkun olam in the very, very mundane sense of making progress in life. But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai says they've made everything for themselves. He's not willing to see any value in it. It's all self-serving. They've built marketplaces to set harlots in them. Like they have, there's a, how do you say in English? There's a whorehouse in the market that's part of Greco-Roman culture. Baths to rejuvenate themselves. Bridges to levy tolls. The bridges aren't for us. They just get their tolls when we go to one place to another. It's all for them. And we get some value from it. It's not worth it. I don't appreciate it. There's nothing to it. It's not important. It's all a distraction, says Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. They've imposed their physical, technological life upon us, and we don't want it. We'd rather just stay with our study houses and learn Torah. I guess Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai would look at Rabbi Yehuda and say he's a dangerous assimilationist. He appreciates modern culture too much. He doesn't see the insidious danger in it. Same arguments exist today. Right? Ah.
What did she say?
I was driven leap. I read it too long ago. Does this come up there?
This is how it started.
Oh, it's how it started.
Yeah.
Well, no, this is after that time. This is after Elisha ben Avuya's time. Elisha ben Avuya was a... His student was Rabbi Meir.
But that's the time of Rabbi Akiva and Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai.
I guess it is. Yeah.
And anyway, that book is not organized completely historically. Anyway, so the Roman government is very, very protective of its honor. It decrees that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai should be executed. Let's go on.
You have to. We have a mission to Tikkun Olam to. We have a mission to help the world to make a difference, to help improve the world.
But Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai would say...
We have to get away, we have to transcend the world and get away from it.
Right, he would say we improve the world on the spiritual plane, but not this physical stuff.
Weren't we supposed to be a light unto the nations?
What type of light? A spiritual light, says Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai.
There it is.
Okay? He and his son... By then, his son is Rabbi Elazar. Rabbi Elazar is the son of Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. He and his son went and hid themselves in the Beit Midrash. And each day, his wife brought him bread and a jug of water, and they ate. Let's just think about that. He flees to the Beit Midrash, and he just studies all day with his son, and his wife brings him bread and water every day. So he is actually fleeing to his ideal state. He's in the study house. That's where he should be. That's where all Jews should be. And he's not involved in physicality at all. He's not in the marketplace. He's not going over the bridges. He's not participating in commerce and life. He doesn't go to the bathhouse. He's just in the study hall. And his wife brings him bread and water. That's all you need to live is bread and water. And the bread and water is really, going back to what we heard from the end of the room there, it really reminds us of the desert. She is really playing the role of God, in a certain sense, bringing them down the manna and providing water miraculously. And he just gets it, and he's totally involved in the spiritual life. On the other hand, you could also look at it a little bit differently, doesn't contradict. In one sense, she's God, the wife, right? Like God provided, so she provides. On the other hand, she's also a link to the physical world. She's a link to the physical world. Now remember, we learned in the previous story that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai is suspicious of valences. They don't work. You have to have extremes. Thank you. So in a certain sense, a balance is now created, a kind of a 90%, 10%, there's still a balance. He has a certain connection to the physical world. It's her. And therefore, we'll read in the next line that she's dangerous. Because she's a connection to the physical world.
Because she's a woman and she's weak, is what he said. So I'm really not a fan of him.
I knew from the outset that you wouldn't be a fan of him.
It reminds me of a Buddha of the Upanishads, to give up all attachments to the world.
Give up all attachments.
Yeah, yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. But when the decree became more severe, the Romans now were really searching house to house for this Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai. He said to his son, "Women are of a weak temperament. She may be subject to torture and expose us." So his only link to the physical world is his potential downfall. And what he's going to have to do is sever even that link. By the way, in rabbinic thought, women very often symbolize corporality, symbolize the material world. Remember, women are not educated, they don't go to school, they don't go to the Beit Midrash, they don't learn Torah, they symbolize physicality. And she was his one link to the physical world, to the civilized world. And now he feels that link is dangerous to him. He's going to have to sever even that and go 100% to the extreme of spirituality.
Didn't he need her to procreate? I mean, isn't that part of his job in following the Torah?
His son is already born. What do we need anymore? But remember, that's very, very physical.
Right. I mean, he needs her.
I guess she's finished with her with that use. As you all know, I never express my personal opinion in this class. I just read what the text says. So they went and hid in a cave. He really becomes a monk, right? Now, of course, this is written long before the development of the spiritual practices of the monks in Christianity, but here you see that same basic idea. So they went and hid in a cave. By the way, for those who are into Greek philosophy, I'll just say
the
one hint. Plato's cave. Make the comparison. So they went and hid in a cave. A miracle occurred in a carob tree, and a spring of water were created for them. So now you don't need the woman, the connection to the physical world, to bring the food and the water. It comes directly from God. They would strip their garments and sit up to their necks in sand. The whole day they studied. When it was time for prayers, they went and robed and covered and went forth and prayed. A string of staccato verbs. And then put off their garments again so that they should not wear out. Remember in the desert, we're told that for 40 years their garments didn't wear out miraculously. They tried to recreate the situation in which their garments won't wear out, as if they're going to be there forever. Right? So they just sit naked, covered by sand, all day and study Torah. You can't study Torah when you're naked, so they were covered with sand. But to pray, they have to stand up. So they went and prayed and put off. So they went and robed and covered and went forth and prayed. Why that string of staccato verbs? To indicate how quickly they went to pray and come back in order not to take time away from their Torah study. And you would say, wait a second, why does Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai want to pray so quickly and go back to Torah study? Isn't he involved in spirituality? And prayer is spirituality. No, prayer is not spirituality. Prayer is really part of the mundane world. Because what is the essence of Jewish prayer? To request for your physical needs.
Petitionary prayer.
Petitionary prayer. Jewish prayer is really about connecting the spiritual to the physical. And he has nothing to do with that. He prays as quickly as possible to get back to that which is really spiritual, the life of the soul and the intellect. By the way, there's a passage, another place in the Talmud, that says that Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai was of the opinion that those who are totally dedicated to Torah study don't have to pray at all. Just skip it. It's only people who also take time for the physical world that they can pray, but it's not for the true scholars. So again, prayer is about physicality. You know, look at the Shemona Asra and the Siddur, right? It's all about this world. So Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son, they're extreme. They're extremely extreme. Right? So they're in the desert being fed by God, being involved in his spirituality. Remember, in the desert, the cloud of glory, God was always with them. So God is always with them in the cave. God's Torah is always with them in the cave. Thus they dwelt 13 years in the cave. By the way, in some texts there's a different version. It says 12 years. What's 1 year, give or take? Then Eliyahu came and stood at the entrance to the cave. Eliyahu, that's Elijah the prophet, a representative of God, and stood at the entrance to the cave and exclaimed, "Who will inform Bar Yochai that the emperor is dead and his decree annulled?" Now, I think it's interesting that God doesn't tell him to leave the cave. There's no criticism, I think, here yet of what he did, of being in the cave all these years. It's also interesting that Eliyahu stood at the entrance to the cave but doesn't go in. Like, the cave is another realm. That's the realm of the spirit, and nothing could enter there, not even the prophet Eliyahu.
Like the Pardes, like God ate it.
It's there. Like the Garden of Eden. It's the complete, absolute realm of the spiritual. So they emerged. Interesting. Why did they emerge? I mean, if they left it so much, why did they leave?
That's exactly what, yeah. So they were actually there in hiding because they didn't want to be caught. So is that really a valid reason for for doing all this, all these...
But aren't they also in their ideal place? That's all they're doing?
Yeah. Right, on the one hand, why do they want to emerge? Perhaps the fact that Eliyahu told them that the decree is finished, they understood that's a hint from God that they should come out. But it's really not clear. What do they leave?
He really didn't want to be in the cave. He was running away from his wife.
He was running away, not from his wife per se, but from the danger.
His wife was going to turn him.
Yeah. But now the decree is over. So they emerged. Seeing a man plowing and sowing, they exclaimed, "They forsake eternal life and engage in temporal life." So understand for a second. Plowing and sowing, that's the preeminent economic activity. Mm-hmm. And the two men, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son, they say concerning people who plow, which means almost everyone, they don't just say that man, they say they forsake eternal life and engage in temporal life. Because we in the cave, that was eternal life. That was connection to God, who's the real provider of eternity, of spirituality. Whereas these people who are plowing and planting, they don't get it. They have their values all mixed up. Why do they think it's so important to plow and to plant and to reap? What's so good about that? What do you get out of it? Bread. There's nothing godly there. So what? Bread could come from a carob tree. That's fine. All you need is a carob tree and a little bit of water. You don't need all of this technology and all of this effort and all of this attention to It's a complete perversion of what a human being should really be doing. Say, Rabbi Shimon bar Yochai and his son, Elazar. People just don't get it. Whatever they cast their eyes upon was immediately burnt up. Because these men had such power of spirituality from their Torah study, and they had such a zealous passion for the truth, that their zealousness is expressed in their eyes, that burning glance that can turn you into a heap of bones, and it does. It turns everything they look at into ashes.
Isn't that against God's law?
Next line. Thereupon a heavenly echo came forth and cried, "Have you emerged, destroying my world? Return to your cave."
But we don't pay attention to heavenly voices.
Here we do. Here we do. So, the question is, which is my world? Rabbi Shimon Yochai said, God's real world is the spiritual world, and all these people are forsaking it by plowing and planting. But God says, no, you got it all wrong. So here comes the rebuke. God says, my world is the world of this table, the world of this field, the world of clothing, the world of food, the world of economic progress. That's my world. Now, I don't know if God is saying, I'll say it differently, God is not saying that my world is the physical and not the spiritual. God's not repudiating his Torah. But he's saying there has to be, everyone together, balance. Balance. You can't say that it's just the spiritual world and just burn up everything else because it's not worth anything. I want this world, says God. I created it. I need it. It's valuable. Back to your cave. So now, the cave is a punishment from God. And earlier, as it was a type of punishment from the Romans. They're fleeing the Romans. But now, it's a punishment from God. And they're going there not to be able to just be involved in the spiritual. They're going there to learn a lesson. And they know what lesson they're supposed to learn. God said, you can't burn up my world. And so they're there for a period of introspection, which God wants them to learn the meaning of balance, apparently, right? And the question is, are they going to learn their lesson?
So, while he was in the cave, supposedly he wrote the Zohar, while he was in the...
And according to later tradition, in the cave all these years, that's where he wrote the Book of Mysticism. Of course, mysticism is about the other world, in a certain sense. That's why tradition attributes the Book of Mysticism to this particular figure, to Rabbi Shimon Bar Yochai.
12.
So they returned and dwelt there 12 months, saying, the punishment of the wicked in hell is limited to 12 months. Now there's tradition that the wicked are punished in hell for 12 months. And they said to themselves, yeah, God found something wrong with us and he sent us into the cave, but it can't be more than 12 months because that's the maximum. So they understand that they're there to be punished. They understand they're supposed to be learning a lesson, and they understand it's not going to be for 12 years. It's only going to be for 12 months.
So is that why you say God is for 11 months?
Yes, 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 yes. A heavenly echo then came forth and said, go forth from your cave, and they went out. So they understood it's only supposed to be 12 months, and God also told them to leave the cave. And now, of course, they're going to be tested. Have they learned their lesson? Wherever Rabbi Elazar smote, Rabbi Shimon healed.
I don't understand that.
What that probably means is that Rabbi Elazar continued to gaze on the world and destroy it. The younger rabbi, right, he's the son, wasn't able within 12 months to moderate his stance. And you know, younger people are often more radical and zealous. Rabbi Shimon healed. In other words, Rabbi Elazar would look at something and it would turn into a burnt forest. Rabbi Shimon would look at it and it would come back to life. So between the two of them, what's created?
Balance.
Isn't that interesting? And then, right, and then the next line might express that idea. My son, you and I are sufficient for the world. In other words, with the two of us, you being more unrepentant and me having learned, it balances out. Apparently he's saying that the world does need some people who are focus just on the spiritual, but they have to be balanced out by others who undo the damage that that radical approach causes. On the eve of the Sabbath, before sunset, they saw an old man holding two bundles of myrtle and running at twilight. What are these for? They asked him. They are in honor of the Sabbath. In other words, they saw a Jew doing a mitzvah in the physical world. They saw him honoring the Sabbath with something that he had planted and harvested. They saw an example of balance, of harnessing the physical for the spiritual. but one should suffice you. He said, what do you need to honor the Sabbath with two myrtle branches? Why not just one? One is for Zachor, and the other is for Shamor. Remember the Ten Commandments, one place it says honor the Sabbath, or remember it, one it says observe. So he said, I'm balancing the two the two aspects of Shabbat. Said he to his son, see how precious are the commandments to Israel. And that's a certain acceptance of the way Jews live in the physical world. They do mitzvot in the physical world, and that is their expression of connecting the physical to the spiritual. By the way, the words thereupon their mind was set at ease are in some of the manuscripts, and they're not in other manuscripts. And that itself, perhaps, is a sense of ambiguity in the tradition, Jewish tradition. Is the problem really solved, or is it not? Are the two of them, father and son, really now able to live in the physical world? Are their minds at ease? Have they got it? Or perhaps, like I said, some manuscripts leave out those words. Perhaps they really are not at ease. They're still uncomfortable with the physical world. Ready to go on? Are we still here?
Where are you? People outside waiting to go.
But it's only...
No, it's over.
I'm sorry, I didn't realize. We're in the middle of the story. We'll have to finish next time, right? Okay, I'm sorry.
If everyone...
Thank you for putting that to
thank
me.
Thank you. No, I just saw people outside in the hallway, right? Debating whether to walk in or not.
Time went too fast.